You are listening to a Triple Canopy podcast. To hear more, visit www.canopycanopycanopy.com.
Okay, so welcome everyone. Welcome back for those who are with us for the first session of the day with Sukhdev Sandhu, Christine Smallwood, and Lynn Tillman on criticism. We are now turning to the matter of style. You're at the Emily Harvey Foundation, and this event is convened by the magazine Triple Canopy. I'm Lucy Ives, and this is Sarah Resnick.
Hello.
So on the matter of style and prose and genre, some of the key questions that we had concerned ourselves with in organizing today's event. What is style? Is there style? Is it something that belongs to language itself, or is it created by the writer? And can one make an argument or a fiction by means of style alone? And perhaps let's talk a little bit about style's relationship to audience, too. So apparently I will say this too. We are extremely pleased to have with us today Hilton Alls, who is a writer and theater critic at The New Yorker. He was formerly a writer and picture editor at The Village Voice and editor-at-large at Vibe. He received a Guggenheim Fellowship in 2000, and his fantastic latest book, White Girls, was published by McSweeney's in 2013. And just to note for those who are new, we asked everyone who's speaking today to choose a text that in some way embodied or expressed or troubled some of the issues at stake, and Hilton selected Kennedy Fraser's The Fashionable Mind, which is a collection of this writer's columns for The New Yorker.
And we also have Rivka Galchin, whose most recent book is really wonderful. It's called Little Labors, and it's a miscellany about babies and literature. She is also the author of the short story collection, American Innovations, and the novel Atmospheric Disturbances, which won the Williams Saroyan International Prize for Writing. And for the occasion, Rivka selected Hilary Mantel's essay, Royal Bodies, from the London Review of Books in February 2013.
Both Hilton and Rivka will read a bit or say a bit, and then they will have a conversation about style. I hope you'll give them a round of applause to welcome them. Thank you for being here.
I think we have to pick these up. Is this working for you now? The very sweet Lucy emailed me about this. I said yes because of Triple Canopy, and I had also taught Lucy's class a little bit at Pratt, and she's so physically attuned to literature, and it's a very, very unusual thing. And so then she sent some questions asking about style and so on, and I almost burst into tears at the computer because I was so tired. And I said, I'm so tired, do I have to write anything? And she said, no. She jumped in very quickly with that. And I thought what I would do to open up the conversation is give two examples of what I think style means in terms of shaping a literature, particularly when it comes to the ways in which women and people of color are represented in print. Generally, those are, for me anyway, the paragons of a kind of style that has something to do, or a great deal to do, with survival. So I'm going to, I think, read a little bit from Kennedy Fraser's first column. It used to be called, I know, don't freak out, but the column used to be called Feminine Fashions. And she disliked it so much that she wrote these kind of insanely brilliant, on the level of Ellen Willis writing about rock criticism, pieces. And the first piece she wrote, I think she was all of 24, and just fresh from Oxford and living in New York for the first time. And this is a definition of looking as a way of informing style. The ways you write can sometimes come from the outside, from the world outside, and inform your sensibility and language. So this first column was called Hail Covered Knee, and I'll read you the first graph. The fashionable woman has long legs and aristocratic ankles, but no knees. She has thin, veiled arms and fluttering hands, but no elbows. Her chest is rather flat. So are her hips. She has a tiny waist and lots of ribs. She wears her skirt around the calf. She welcomes the return of the dress and is happy to find clothes that look new and that are not, perforce, some kind of trouser suit, pajama suit, or jumpsuit. She wants soft fabrics, light wool, jersey, crepe, chiffon, and crepe de chine, in tranquil colors such as brown. Sorry, I think it's very funny. In tranquil colors such as brown, smoky blue, mauve, gray, and deep, dull pink. She likes beige and black, but never chooses royal blue or white or red. She wants no linings and no stiffening. She takes fresh pleasure in the elegant detail of pleats and tucks and smocking. She wears few underclothes. She prizes practicality and comfort, but does not fear experiment. Most of all, she wants to have fun. She is in genteel revolt against all clothes, kinetic, psychedelic, geometric. She is wearied by cutouts, by zips that end in curtain rings, by vinyl, and by parliamentary buttons. She is tired of looking like an upside-down ice cream cone with arms and legs. She rejected this uniform shape and the above-knee length some time ago, and she toys with mid-calf coats and maxi coats and trousers. She wraps herself in wayside blossoms or dresses in mock-up scaparelli and revels in a display of real or spurious decadence. She is unperturbed by occasional vulgarities and is never boring. This woman could be any age. I think that that is kind of the maxim for me in terms of writing anything at all. You never want to be boring. And you want to have lots of ribs in the in the writing, because what she's really talking about are the ways in which the female body is perceived as a social creature and the general feeling about women's bodies. And by going into the specifics, she makes a joke of the general. And I think that style, ultimately for me anyway, is about a rounding up of the specifics in order to make a literature that is you, because that is what Marion Moore, the great poet, taught us, that style was really the radiograph of the soul. And as Deanna Vreeland said so brilliantly and epigrammatically, style helps you get down the stairs.
You mentioned style as a survival tactic. Yeah. And there's like both when you read that passage, there's a sense of kind of the joy and sort of being fluent in all of this and the sort of distress and realizing this level of fluency in this language that not everyone is required to be fluent in. And, right. And it's even sort of alluding to the connection of style being on the one hand an expression of self, on the other hand a way to not be yourself so that you can mark yourself sort of incorrectly and move in the social ladder and move up the social class. And I'm just kind of curious, what you think about that, because recently I was thinking about just the way that you talk about building your own style, primarily, for example, from like white women in cinema. Right. And what does that mean, and where's the kind of anxiety, where's the kind of triumph, where's the whatever, all those things.
Oh, that's a really good question. I think that that for me anyway, that style, that I was always interested in style as the voice of the person. I'm always attracted much more to how someone says something as opposed to what they say. And so style begins, I think, with this idea of framing. How do you frame the thing that you want to talk about? It, of course, the event can dictate what it is that you mean to write about or report or think about, but in a way, it has to marry with your subjectivity. I think that it's silly to teach people or to read anything really without having the idea that the writer is behind what is being said. So I think that, you know, there are brilliant people like Janet Malcolm who makes herself a character in the story, for instance, or I think other incredible people that you should read, like George Trow, were interested in the ways in which they could observe something happening through style without being a part of it. So for me, when I was a kid, the performances or that I was always interested in had something to do and still have something to do with hysteria. Style grows out of this need to communicate something of your experience very, very dramatically or drastically. If you look at old footage of Janis Joplin, for instance, or early film performances of Jane Fonda, or any number of people that I love, you can see that there's this kind of impatience to communicate who they are. And who they are is this incredible amalgamation of forces that they are conscious of and unconscious of simultaneously. Wouldn't you say that you were the sum of many parts?
No, just one, really. No, but I mean, what I love about sort of what is coming through in these things is the way that there's kind of an above ground thing going on with style, which is very deliberate and choosing and trying to sort of express something directly, and a kind of underground thing where there's a part of style that's trying to obscure and cover up or make something unacceptable or social, something asocial,
right.
Find a way to be in the social sphere.
Well, that's a great segue to reading George Trow's. George Trow was an amazing writer, and he wrote a piece that you should all look up and Xerox for each other called "The Within the Context of No Context." And in that piece, he was a white gay man who had a very particular interest in Black American culture. And there's a section of the piece that I'll read to you now about the Pointer Sisters. Do you guys, you may be too young, but they were, do you remember? They were this very great dynamic singing group in the 70s who, well, I'll read you what he says. And then you'll hear, you'll see. The Pointer Sisters, 1973. The Pointer Sisters were four Black women, Ruth, Anita, Bonnie, and June, who wanted not to be poor, not to be unknown, not to live in Oakland, California. For a while, they were backup singers. Then, under the influence of their manager, David Rubinson, they began to sing songs in the style of the 40s, in clothes in the style of the 40s, in a manner that was Negro rather than Black. One night, they went by car out from San Francisco to a suburban place to see a performance by Josephine Baker, a Black woman from St. Louis who wanted not to live in St. Louis, and who in the 20s learned how to embody one aspect of glamour and coquetry, and who, after that, had sustained a vogue in France. It was not the idea of the Pointer Sisters to see Miss Baker. A group of white fans had suggested it. Down the street, dark night, certain flashing lights. Condor, topless. Bonnie, looking pretty, said, I just love to drive down this street. I can't help it. I just love those ladies. Bonnie had a nice fur coat, new. The Pointer Sisters drove right out of town. Things dispersed. The theater was like a bunker, something in cement. The Pointer Sisters walked in. Inside the theater was like a round room with a small circular stage at the center. The room was not half full. People were not scattered all around, gaps everywhere. Nothing tight. The Pointer Sisters walked past a door in the perimeter of the hall. The Pointer Sisters walked down an aisle covered with gray substance, not much like carpeting, like something to keep the dust down, like something to cover cement. Soon after the Pointer Sisters were seated, the lights went down, and Josephine Baker ran, almost ran, to the stage, down the aisle and over the gray substance, which must have been a pad for a proper rug that had been taken up. Josephine Baker wore a peach-colored costume, tight-fitting and studded with sequins. She looked just like a dream, several things at once. A star, but that was just the start. Then a lady, but that was just the start. Then a lady who knew when not to be a lady and how to please and how to have a little moment of this and one of that, not teasing, flirting. Does anyone know the difference? A tease is a con. You press a spot because you know that it can be pressed, and while the sucker is feeling the pleasure of the pain resulting from the pressure, you take something from him. Do you have the money? Good, good, she'll be right down. Wait here, she'll be right here. And then nothing. A flirt doesn't do that. A flirt does a dance within the context of giving pleasure, referring to this, referring to that. And suddenly, following the references, you find a little surprise. Nothing enormous, nothing like feed on me, nothing like that. Something small with a bow on it. It's a pleasure, a surprise, and a gift. The idea of performance, for me anyway, has something to do with not only the need to communicate who the performer is, but also this idea of bestowing the gift of style onto the audience. I think that style, for me anyway, is something that I've not seen before. So if you go back to insane footage of, let's say, the Supremes and Diana Ross's neck and her popping out her eyes and moving in that insane way that she did when she weighed 80 pounds and was 24 years old. Those are extreme examples of how style communicates beyond what is being said. So I think there's a fight for me between the language of style, which is where the meaning is for me, and also how to sort of get content in there that's equal to the voice.
Another question, I guess, is that idea of, you can sort of flip it, right? You can sort of say, well, the content is just really kind of the fabric you sort of use. Like, it's almost, sometimes the content feels like it doesn't have that much content, and almost all the content feels like it's in the sort of surface choices, that's where the real center of a piece is. But in a piece of prose and like in a piece of work like you do for The New Yorker so regularly, you have such a strong content obligation. Mm-hmm. And does that feel, how do you sort of navigate that in terms of, is that something working against you, like some heavy weight to lift, or is that just what you're working with?
I think that I've always just been I think if you cumulatively or collectively, if you read those pieces, a lot of the time I don't get to the play until the very end of the piece, because I'm interested in the style of performance. Here's the thing about theater, is that no one really is thinking about the writer or the director. We're watching people in kind of medium shot, right? They're in permanent medium shot doing this thing that has some resemblance to reality. Generally, the plays that interest me have much more of a relationship to language or style. So what I'm following is not only what the actors are saying, but how they're moving. And that really tells, I don't want to suggest that they performers should take mime or tap or anything, but what they're doing is really sort of telling the story that's separate from the script. And so the style of performance that interests me, again, to go back to this idea of hysteria, has something to do with being given the opportunity to perform because there's a story that they have to tell, but really the story is secondary to how they're telling it, and that's really how I prefer to approach criticism. So the obligation, I'm not a very good student of anything, and I was a terrible student. Generally, if there's a comment from my editor, and fortunately I work with Deborah Treisman, who's the fiction editor, and she'll just have a little query and saying, and then what happened, or wonderful, or was there an end to the play, or I got so lost in what you were saying that I forgot to ask, was there a plot point? I'm given a great deal of what is that word when you're giving room? What latitude? I'm given a great deal of latitude to express through language what the experience has been. And to me, the real job of criticism is to describe what the experience for you is, and then how these various signifiers come into play.
Well, I mean, another sort of luxury or difficulty of theater criticism, and one of the reasons I love your pieces, but it's because when I read theater criticism, most of the time I'm not ever going to see that play.
No.
It's not a movie. And so the text has like a different
yes.
life right away.
You might want to save that for last because you're not going to see the play, right? Yeah, so you're just, I'm fine. I would do it myself if I wasn't writing them. But I think that to make something, but you write about TV and stuff, and how.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about what a different job it is to write about something that you assume everyone in your audience has not only seen but talked about with all of their friends, and that, like, a private...
You can't write like that at all. You can't... I just assume that I'm interested in it. That's really where it begins and ends. For me, with anything... I have this wonderful friend, and... I was sort of very nervous about dating someone who was in a different realm. And she kept doing this wonderful hand gesture.
What's a realm? The arts?
No.
A realm, okay.
Yeah, his milieu. And so she kept doing this gesture, and I wanted to laugh so hard because I really am stealing it now all the time for things that should be inconsequential. And she kept saying, oh, who cares, who cares, when she's talking to me. So I feel that, oh, who cares, when it comes to who you think might be the person that you're reading for or writing for, or the assumption that you would make about the audience, because it really has to start with you. And if you're lucky, people will pay attention. But it's almost sort of like a very deep afterthought for me. The thing that interests me is, let's say, the experience of being here with you and this audience, that's deeply interesting to me. I would be delighted and surprised if someone tweeted something that someone then emails me about it. It's very, I've never been that way, and I guess I'll tell you why, since you asked. The experience that I have of editing with Deborah very much mirrors how I started writing, which was that I would write something when I was a kid, and I would leave it on the dining room table for my mother, who would then, I would go to bed, and then she would wake up and read it and write her comments and then leave it for me. So Deborah and I never really talk about writing, and I started by not discussing writing. I just did it. So it's the doing for me that is profound, and also having that one person that cares is really all that I require.
I mean, it's interesting to me that you're having a fiction editor edit it, because a lot of, I think often a lot of my favorite criticism to read, for example, like old criticism, not so old, but I love Frank Kermode. He's this quiet, he never seems very upset or very passionate, and weirdly I find that refreshing. And when I read it, I often am never going to read, because he did a lot of kind of workaday criticism, just writing about whatever he needed to write about that day, not always like great books or something I'm going to go back and read. And so when I read it, I just am sort of going through the experience of being with this very quiet, careful kind of mind, which is not what, I'm not sure that's what he was intending to perform. It just is his constant performance.
Well, it's his style.
It's his style. Yes. And I think like having a fiction editor, I wonder how it is for you, because I think often with a lot of my favorite fiction to read, I almost am enjoying it in a way that I privately like to think the fiction writer didn't mean to, that they themselves are sort of like doing something fairly unconscious, a kind of performance in their sleep.
Yeah. I know, I agree with you totally that the language that, well, I'm drawn to, and it seems that you're drawn to as well, has a lack of self-consciousness about it, because what we're really looking for when we say style, I think, is a great measure of authenticity, that what we're looking for in any experience is the authentic. And so I think that things like criticism or museum shows or literature have moved away from the impulses that we had originally, which is to, we've had this deep ecstatic experience that has been transformative in some way, and what gets in the way, I think, is the business of literature, or the business of curatorial practice, or the business of book publishing. And if you get swept up in that, then you're losing what was always the thing that you liked, which was my mother responding, or Deborah responding. And I think that the fight always, in terms of not just keeping your voice if you have style or are interested in style, but also in terms of keeping your relative innocence vis-a-vis the project, that there's something that you want to communicate, and it is of utmost importance that you communicate it, no matter how strangely it's shaped or how strangely it sounds. There is this desire, and I think we lose that more and more the more we do it in a professional capacity. So that's why I'm a bad New Yorker writer, because I'm not very professional. I mean, I do it on time and all that. But I don't know how to do it in terms of the collective voice. I know how to do it as myself. And I think that the writers that I've read today a little bit knew how to do it as themselves. And when you figure out how to do it as yourself, then the institution, no matter what the institution is, if you're just that dogged and also maybe crazy, they start to work with you, as opposed to marginalizing you. If there's enough of you, of that voice, of that style, the institution starts to work with you, because you become the commodity that they need to survive. There's this great, go look it up on YouTube, but there's this amazing thing, Bette Davis talks about how she had been at Warner Brothers for 19 years, and on her last day, she drank in her trailer with the cameraman and somebody else and a dresser. And the Dick Cavett says, well, didn't Jack Warner come down with flowers? She says, no. It's not their job to love you. It's, you can have the most immense gratitude to them for helping you be you, but it is not their job to love you. And I think, for me, I've never assumed that an arrangement, a business arrangement, whether it was at The Voice or
would you like
Vibe,
your mom, okay?
They're not my mother. They pay me, and then there are other people too. So because you know that, you have to be true to you, true to your voice, and true to this experience of literature that you're trying to bring to someone, people that you don't know.
But I guess it's like the sort of, you know, innocent sense of being true to yourself, and then at some point you sort of grow up and you sort of see how many things that seem sort of deeply you might want to alter or change, and then there's some other sort of new innocent sort of unself-consciousness. And
you mean in your individual
well,
self?
Well, like just to give a terrible...
Or other people.
Just to give a cheap, terrible example, I was thinking about how devastated I was when I realized that, like, because you mentioned it, you read it in the Kennedy Fraser, my own preference for flat-chestedness and, like, certain kinds of outfits was just, like, the general preference for prepubescent girls to women. Right. Just, like, I was like, oh, that feels so deeply me and... so deeply part of my style and my sense of myself. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, like, I recognize it's like a weighted thing we might take issue with.
Well, it started in England, right? This idea of the malnourished woman as being fashionable. and it became something that was integrated into American culture, forever and fundamentally, it seems, in the 1920s. And so the preference for one's own, I don't know, it's something that I try to help people resist by questioning what the preference is and where does it grow out of. If you can give people or a friend a context, it gives them more questions about what they assume beauty is or isn't. How did you come up to this? Like, how did you grow up with this idea that was an ideal shape, for instance?
I mean, I think because it was everywhere, and that what I guess what I'm thinking about, although I think that's an endless, deep question.
I can't tell you, I lived in Berlin for 5 months years ago, and I swear to you, I got off the plane and they were driving me to the place where I was going to live, and I looked out the window and I saw girls eating hot dogs and riding bicycles and drinking beer, and I burst into tears. I'd never seen women so free in my life. I wanted them to stay there forever and feed them meat chips or whatever they wanted. But it was just, they just didn't, that wasn't the conversation. The conversation was what they were doing or what was interesting wasn't.
Well, I mean, I guess I feel...
It wasn't Spanx related, let's put it that way.
I feel like that's interesting in a million... In fact, I even sort of have a theory about performative eating, performative steak eating, that kind of thing, but...
Ooh.
But I guess...
I can't wait. Yeah.
But I was trying to bring up this... obviously to neon piece of content to think about the style issue of that moment when there's sort of unself-conscious expression of self, which is sort of like on the one hand, like what seems to make good art, and then that moment where you're like, oh, this unconscious self-expression of me is not so me, and I could elect to alter it, whether your model is like Keats or whoever your model might be, but there are certain things that are part of this kind of naturalness that aren't so natural. And how does that change the still sort of deep value of style and where we conscious or unconscious we want to be
think that naturalness contradicts style. I think that it's natural to the stylish person. That again, this goes back to the question of or the reality really of authenticity. And the thing that sounds good to me is natural to me, and it may not be to 50,000 other people, but what does that matter when I have it right for myself? I think that the first principle of writing with style or writing about the question of style is how true is it of me to say this thing that I'm saying? You know when it's not right, because it's or I know when it's not right, is because I'm having a deeply unpleasant physical response to the thing that I've just written, and it's because it's not true. And I don't mean in the sense of fiction or nonfiction, which is another thing to talk about, but true to the emotional weight of the experience or the imaginative experience. I think when you read something, I just read The House of Mirth for the first time, and I just was so amazed by how true the character was to this. I wanted to bring her up, Lily Bart, in terms of style, because she is a stylish person who can see through the social convention of style, right? Her originality is what gets punished. Style as the thing that is you. But what is rewarded is style as fashion. When you become a fashionable person, you're an accepted person, but when you're a stylish person, you better have your own self, because the fashionable people are not gonna be, when the revolution comes, they won't be there. But you will be there looking stylish. But don't, it's just something that I caution. I have lots of young friends, and particularly I find with younger women that there's this rush to satisfy what the status quo says should be satisfied. And it's almost sort of a physical pulling them away from what's expected in order to find their own self. I think I've been reading this wonderful essay that Ellen Willis wrote about Janis Joplin, and she said that she had the curse of, she said the primary curse for American girls is unpopularity. This idea that you have to conform or be part of something, and I think that the artists.
I've always said the primary curse for American girls is popularity.
Oh, right. Yeah. Exactly. Fail that chorus. Because there's no learning. Poor Lily couldn't speak past what was expected of her, but her interiority, her life of the mind, is such a valuable lesson in going the course and not letting the tragedy of fashion overwhelm you.
Except for that she dies of a sleeping pill overdose alone in her apartment.
Exactly.
But alone is better
than with the wrong people.
I think also,
let me just, to that point, Elizabeth Hardwick wrote this in Sleepless Nights, this sort of fear. She wrote about this fear or what it looked like when a woman was alone, sort of, she said, like dreadful oxen, uncared for. But Agnes Martin, in her wonderful collection of writings, which I quote to juxtapose them, says, spending time alone has gotten really a bum rap. And it really is kind of amazing to have your own voice and hear yourself and work out of that.
She's such a wonderful example of someone that when you encounter her work, you feel like it's private and you get to see it.
Also, like, deeply sexy. Hello.
Yeah.
What's, like, hotter than somebody who knows themselves? It's not, like, you're not going to go for the person that is sort of the cookie-cutter version.
But what?
Have you? I don't know. But what we're looking for really is the individual, and we're looking for the authentic experience.
But I like to think about Lily Bart again, like, because that's a, I think it's such a like rich example. And one thing that still like troubles me about that book, which is like a perfect engine of a book, is that one reason Lily Bart is so appealing is that she is a genius. She's just a step better than everyone else at reading what is going to signal that she has significant cultural capital to be chosen by, like, a man with substantial financial capital, even though she doesn't have the class. And there's this, and part of why she's so, I feel like she's a Don Quixote figure, or Quixote figure, in the sense that she has the genius to do this, and then she says, I'm not going to trade it in. Mm-hmm. She displays it, and yet at the same time, as a reader, especially, you know, if I often think of like the immigrant, I feel like an immigrant mother when I read House of Mirth. I think I support your decision, but you're gonna die. And so it's that, and so again, I feel like it's kind of a part of why the novel is so amazing to me is that you see genuinely the cost of becoming so sophisticated. And you still think, well, I'm glad she chose not to deploy her sophistication in this terrible way because it's its own genius. Mm. And yet, you almost feel like Edith Wharton is like, see, that's what you get.
I don't think that it was instructive on a moral level. I think that the pathos of the book is not just what we feel for Lily, but what she feels for other people. Even though she is being marginalized and on some level critiqued, she can still see the limitations of other people, and she can be very generous about that. I think that you can only have that kind of generosity when you're not worried fundamentally what other people think about you, that you can be free enough to do the kind of writing that interests me anyway, which has everything to do with your voice, and your voice really is something that can't be be negotiated through other people. I think of Lily Moore as a writer in this story, and that she just didn't have that particular outlet. But had she would have been, I don't know, Edith Wharton. And so, and so the idea of suffering for your stylistic invention or singularity, I don't really buy that. I think that has everything to do with how you treat this machine, which you need to survive to make the work that is you. I had this great experience recently. I got a letter from the amazing Twyla Tharp saying, oh, I like you. And I was like, ah! And would you come to supper? I was like, ah! And I said, God, this is like Lily Bard. And, not, you know, the first half. And, and I went, and the thing that was so extraordinary about the experience with this great, really master of dance and entertainment was the lack of self-consciousness she had about who she was. And the thing that she was humble about, or that humbled her, was the work itself. Don't you think it comes down to what we're actually doing? That's the thing that is the most, the hardest thing and the humbling thing, but also the most exciting thing in terms of self-creation is creating. I don't know how you do it without making stuff that is you, and the style is you, and the voice is you, and it's the radiograph of your soul. I don't know how any other way to do it. If I did, I would be rich. I'd be taking you all out for beers, but if I knew how to do it, if I knew how to make that voice generic enough so that other people liked it, I wouldn't do it. I haven't been able to, because I don't know what that machine is. I only know this impulse to be excited by the thing that's going to kick my ass when I sit down at that desk. I don't know what it is. And it's going to be transformative, whether it's writing to Lucy and saying, I can't write anything. That means something about the truth of my experience at the time. There was this great thing at the Whitney, and they had his work up for 2 weeks. And it was so moving to sit there. I actually sort of burst into tears during his concert because he was playing for the great dancer, Min. And their connection and their difference was so profound that you could hear his dancing and you could see Cecil's playing. And again, if it comes down to one person who can dance to what you're saying, I think that's really worth it.
I hope I didn't get on and said like that's not worth it.
No. I think that you were
No, I guess I'm just still interested. I sort of feel like, of course, like all the best work, both as like a working artist trying to do your own work, and when you're looking at other work, is the work that somehow feels like it's managed to succeed in being deeply private and coming from sort of that weird engagement with just like whatever it is that's out there, that the person sort of throws themselves up against the thing, and the thing comes back, change, and it goes back and forth. And that seems like where really all the best work comes from. I'm just sort of trying to think also about the problem at the heart of that, which is on the one hand, there is this sense of kind of pure, unencumbered self, and then there's not.
I think that it plays out in literature in certain ways. For instance, this is a terrible thing to say, but if I pick up a book...
Now we're really excited.
If I pick up a book, let's say of contemporary fiction or literature, and it begins, you know, on... So-and-so Saturday, she felt like the sun was, and the building was this,
right,
and she walked along, and I feel that I'm dying inside, because that writer is operating out of a certain set of assumptions about what literature is. I think that the writers that I love are working out of the assumptions that they've created themselves. You know, Kennedy didn't have to start, and she had a job, right? Oh, you will have the feminine fashions column in the New Yorker, and that's supposed to mean reporting about what she saw. Well, she's like, you know, fuck you. I'm going to write about what I see women doing to conform and not conform. Or George Tro writing about blackness in this way that had nothing to do with ideology and everything to do with style and self-perception. So people who are coming at it from their own point of view as opposed to what they learned or what they've read and want to emulate, they're not doing literature or style a favor. They're doing, you know, their publishers a favor.
Well, I also think it's a great example because it gets at like one idea, I think, of how like the sort of pure you expression thing can actually work. And like I think it is really telling that it was in this situation of this kind of annoying format that she sort of found, quote unquote, finds her voice. But that really means something in that situation. And that in a sense it's almost as if the annoying kind of anti-personal format that was not ideal for like natural expression is somehow essential,
right?
Because it kind of bumps you down a deeper layer into your into something less compromised.
Right. I think that style, generally, real style operates between two poles, which is the authentic and the upsetting. And if you upset the status quo and do it in a way that is deeply pleasurable to the ear or eye, you're accomplishing two things at once, and I don't think that they get enough attention. I'm glad that they asked us to talk about it today.
She's pulling the plug.
I don't know if there's a hook.
Yeah, I just finally looked over there.
She's got the hook.
I'm just trying to follow instructions here.
You said Rivka, you have one?
Yeah, Rivka, why don't you respond as you were about to?
Oh, no. I just wanted to tie back to what you said at the beginning, that I sort of think, in a sense, it's worth noticing that where does style usually sort of flourish? And it does tend to flourish in people with less power. And that's almost the sort of fashion column you have to enter in. She had to enter into a fashion column. That's like the voice, and that sort of thing it's going against is part of its story of coming into being.
You had asked me about that in terms of theater criticism, and I don't know, writing is just writing to me. And so if it's a play or if it's you know, history of friends in New York or whatever, I don't want to sort of come from the Stanislavski school of writing, which is If I don't believe it, then it's not going to be true. And if I believe it, it's true. So I come from a place where I have to believe it. I think that's why I'm tired.
Well, just I'm going to ask a quick question, and then I'd like to turn matters over to the audience. But to, for a moment, turn the spotlight on you, Rivka. Your new book, Little Labors, is a book in which you talk about what is ostensibly your own experience. And it's also, it's an extremely informative book, it's an extremely erudite book, and it's also an extremely witty book. And in a conversation on style, and I think this can maybe touch upon some of your points as well, Hilton, you know, what is it to be witty about yourself, witty about what has really happened to you?
It's so. I had a great friend, and I used to say that I would ask him sometimes. I said, "Oh, does your mother have a sense of humor?" And he said, "She better." And I think it's the hardest job out there. So I have nothing to add to that, except to ask you, how do you do it with a sense of humor?
You were saying about how if you believe it, it's true, and I do think there's like I'm not a particularly funny person, but I try to be funnier on the page because you have time.
Yes.
and that thing about it being true, what I do love about like wit or humor and why I rarely doubt it is I think you just can't, you can kind of fake lyricism briefly, like it's like not actually lyrical, but you can tell yourself, I don't know, maybe it was. But there's something really reassuringly accurate or true when with wit. So especially because like I wrote that book with a useful constraint of being like really tired and having no ability to concentrate, I thought, well, that's like my news. The news back to me is that if it has like this feeling of wit, then maybe it has some sort of form of accuracy.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that's a great formulation. So, audience, do you have any questions for us? And if you would like to come to the fore and speak into the microphone, we can definitely do that now. So.
They hate us.
Thank you.
We're hateful panel, Rivka.
Style and all that it encompasses is very complex, but in a very basic way, I think of it as sort of a double-edged sword. And I was struck by something that you said, Rivka, early on about, in response or maybe in contrast to something that Mr. Owls said. Should I call you Mr. Owls or Hilton? Or? you said, and I share this sentiment mostly, that you, the stylish person prefers the way something is said rather than what is being expressed. Yeah. And you maybe expressed a little bit of skepticism towards that. But I like the idea that you mentioned how style can be used effectively to float certain ideas, which might be received with a degree of skepticism by an audience, or even maybe rejected. And I thought of the passage from this wonderful book, which is very appropriate to the conversation, Brian Blanchfield's Proxies, which if you haven't checked it out, you definitely should. And I'm just going to read this brief passage because it's very funny and I think everyone will love it. And it kind of touches on this idea of floating ideas via style or in a way that people maybe don't quite perceive right away. And it's about... W.H. Auden. Okay, he's actually making a correction in his own book. W.H. Auden speculates in a 1969 New York Review of Books piece on J.R. Ackerley's memoir, My Father and Myself, about the latter's sexual predilections. Auden later confided to friends that he relished introducing into print the phrase, the Princeton first year, a euphemism for frottage.
I remember it well.
on the principle.
That's a great piece. I
don't doubt it. On the principle that the particulars of gay sex should not be omitted when relevant in public discourse. The Princeton Rub, in quotations, and sometimes more simply, the Princeton, were also terms in limited use at the time.
Is that like scissoring?
Yes.
The Smith scissor?
I'm so not in there.
No, I think that... That first of all, you should read that book. The Ackerley book is amazing, but I think that Auden, who was a great writer, was trying to sort of debunk the seriousness around certain conversations, homosexuality being one of them, and he wrote the introduction to. Doug Hammarskjöld's Markings, which is also a great book you should read, and he actually got himself disqualified from the Nobel Prize for saying that he was, I think, gay in the introduction. And he wouldn't change it. He wouldn't change what he wrote to help his career. So I think that one of the things that we're talking about here is the price you pay for a certain kind of individuality. Is worth it because then you can live with yourself and you can write about the Princeton Rub or Frottage if you damn well feel like it. So we're free. Yeah, exactly. Do it. Scissor, Frottage, do it.
Are there other questions? Oh, wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I'll lean this way. When you were both speaking about style and content and how style sort of communicates content, the Diana Ross example with the neck. There's so much more communication, like pictorial communication now, emoticons, Instagram, memes. And I think, and I've been thinking about the GIF as this sort of ultimate reduction to gesture or to style because it's just that moment of visual inflection on loop. I'm so sorry. That moment of visual inflection on loop as opposed to, like, that somehow is, like, instinctively understood as opposed to, like, linguistically explained. And I'm wondering if, like, those forms of communication sort of what kind of new horizons they open up or what maybe historical versions of it they echo, of, like, how style has somehow sort of taken off on its own, divorced from language in a way.
I think it's a very interesting eternal problem for most people who have good taste. Most of us want to be acceptable and accepted as having taste that we all understand with one another, but the person that has style or is attracted to style is attracted to a certain kind of recklessness in behavior, recklessness in self-presentation or voice. And I think, for instance, Lemonade, you know? There are 100 producers on it. And the thing that makes it stylish is not so much what she's saying, but the ways in which she's decided to take from her parents' culture to understand her own. So there are fragments of style on the record that gets clobbered by its success, but there, if you listen to songs like Hold Up or Formation, there are fragments of real style there despite the packaging for success. And I think that that record says so much about America and the idea of the individual versus the corporation. I don't think that the real struggle is with her husband. I think the real struggle is with authenticity. I'm going to read you this little thing that Kennedy wrote, an essay about style, okay? It's really good. It makes me feel like a plagiarist, but I don't care. Style. Style is rarely glimpsed in times like these, which at best encourage its humble relative, good taste. While style and taste have been known to intermingle in the past, the currently widening gap between them reminds us once more of their fundamental difference. The world of the merely tasteful, a trim edifice of bourgeois conformities with narrow slots to be filled and straight lines to be towed, is bound to barricade itself in the end against style which is individualistic, aristocratic, and reckless. Taste concerns itself with broad lifetime progress and never makes mistakes. Style moves by fits and starts and is occasionally glorious. Style differs from elegance too, yet they often keep company, since elegance is generally regarded as a prime object in the quest for style. But elegance is static and hermetic, and the moments of its attainment in a life of style are like so many cathedrals along the route of a comprehensive cultural tour. Style requires allegiance to a creed whose shifting nature makes it all the more demanding. But then, style is more rewarding than the ways of elegance or taste. It is more akin to a philosophy, and it is surely closer to an art. Take that. Boof. You fashionable people.
That was beautiful. Would someone else like to offer a comment or a question? Oh, wonderful.
I have two questions, and you can answer whichever you choose. One question is if you can say a little bit more about what style consists in, if it consists in, on the page, a way of thinking, for example, if it consists in certain words, if it consists in, if it's a way of thinking, is it a way of thinking about the world? Is it a way of thinking about the object? Would you use a word like values that could drive style? Why not? I saw you roll your eyes. That's a no. But then my second question is, what about bad style?
Ooh.
And would you just call that no style? Or how do you interface with something that is obviously attempting this idiosyncratic performance of self and then failing?
I just call bad style wrong. But that can be very interesting and fascinating to learn from, too. It's like looking at Miyake Pleats or something, where he aspires to a certain he has a style of creation, but it is bad. And so what do we learn from bad style, I think, has something more to do with, again, this question of authenticity, not making something that looks like fashion but is stylish, and making something that looks like you. And as difficult as that is, I think we can see the dishonesty when the attempt isn't made.
What if you are authentically, what if you're the authentic version of yourself is bad?
I probably slept with you then. Because they have bad style. What? Sorry? Oh, you mean you're talking about the ethics of style?
The way like a speech pattern can seem to speak of a sort of evil because it's sort of devoted to, let's say, grandiose statements, and that's natural to the person is something, and does that have like, is that an example of the aesthetic and the ethic being like united in this expression? I think they've been trying to answer it for about 2,000 years, but I like the idea of trying to push to think, what does it mean? What is a manifestation of style on the page, which is so hard to describe? And I do sort of think it's interesting, because often when I'll think, because you know how you get sort of tired of the fact that you like certain things and you don't like certain things, and you start to think, well, at least I could find out what it is, this thing that I like again and again. And I've noticed that, like, the style that I'm drawn to, which I've come to understand is annoying to a number of people, is like they usually are intellectual habits, the intellectual habit of ever refining a statement, right? So that's like Beckett's style, maybe. Or like the intellectual habit of always going for paradox, just finding your way into the paradox. And I do find like those are, they do have manifestations on the page, and they have kind of thinking correlates And of course, they manifest differently in each person, but it does almost feel like you're encountering someone's biology. Like this person is just
driven to do
this again and again.
I was about to say, do you think that men write differently than women?
Well, I mean, I do.
Just for laughs.
I wasn't thinking of that. I wasn't thinking of that biology.
I know.
But I do.
We have to entertain the people.
We have to entertain the people. You know how I think often people feel this. They feel they have their like natural tribe, their bloodline tribe, and then like you feel like you come across your tribe or whatever, and it's a tribe that's usually manifests in style or something like this. And I used to think of it as this planet. I was like, oh, I'm always like finding people who are from this planet, and I feel I'm not like really from that planet. I'm like an intermediary between Earth and the planet these people are from. And then you think like, oh, like I'm encountering these people across space and time with a kind of certain stylistic bent in their way of being.
Yes.
And it does feel almost.
I think it's like trying to describe what attracts you to a certain person. You know, you might like Leonard, for instance, and you say to me over coffee, "Oh, I really like Leonard." And as a social person, I have to repress the fact that I think Leonard is awful looking and awful. And so that exchange of saying and not saying something is, I think, what makes the issue of style very interesting, and also what Kennedy says philosophical, because it really sort of spins out into things that you can ground in specificities, but at the same time, the more specific you become about it, the more it becomes larger and more philosophical and far-reaching as a conversation. So it's to me tantamount to saying, you know, I like Leonard, or you like spinach, and I don't. In fact, there's a great book called Fashion is Spinach, which you should look up, which was written by the first woman to write about fashion for The New Yorker. And there's something about this issue of style that remains haunting and also so little explored, I think, in literature as a subject in and of itself.
And I like that you that effort made to distinguish taste from style, because I think if taste is like purely like a dog whistle of social class and status, there's like the ideal would be that style is this thing that sometimes resembles taste, merges with taste, but is like in excess and in it and its own thing.
Yes.
So I think we have time for one more question, if there might be one out there. Oh, Sam.
Maybe this is just the nature of what the two of you write about and are interested in, but Is style something that rises above? I mean, and Christine was trying to tie it to the page, but it seems almost like the planet of style that you visit sometimes, Rivka. It might not just be writers, but it might also be, you know, people.
Artists.
Yeah, is style somehow something that rises above literature into some other domain? I mean, it seems like that's been the character of this conversation, but is there a difference between the trans-historical, transmedial style and prose style? Is there a relationship, or does style really not have to do with medium at all? Which seems wrong, but yet keeps happening in this conversation. So,
right, it's almost like that feeling of like is it almost like a kind of law of physics, which is like out there, but we're never gonna like stub our toe on it, but that it kind of does move from like a way of being in a room to a way of writing on the page to a way of seeing to.
It's a habit of being, really. And, you know, I'm equally drawn to drawings by artists that act as a kind of writing to me. and inspire me than to do in writing what I see visually. So the question of are there separate issues, I don't think that they are. I think that because we had an hour, it was limited to writing, but as you can tell, style takes its own course and makes its argument always much bigger than an hour or just writing. I think it really is all-inclusive, and I think it's about creating a world that you want to live in.
If it's all right, I'm just going to ask one more quick question.
Okay.
No, I'm not going to ask one more quick question.
Thank you, everyone, for coming.